Look, we all need a little something-something to get through the day from time to time. For some, it's the suffering souls of those blessed with clairvoyance. Luckily, for most of us, a good cup of coffee will do. And why not upgrade to the best cup of coffee you can get? Switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that are always ethically sourced and fair trade, which is more than I can say for the steam. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this delicious coffee to you in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or you can do it the easy way and sign up for automatic delivery by joining the Autopilot Coffee Club. There's no commitment, just convenience. And you can save 20% off your next order by telling Sparkplug where you heard about them. Just use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. And that's all one word with the number 100. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Coffee's also good for recovering alcoholics. Cigarettes too, I hear. According to the movies.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Happy Federal Election Day here in Canada, and thanks for planting our podcast into the midst of your busy day. This is the 409th Ellis's Analysis here on the Top 100 Project, the weekly podcast that peels back layers of classic motion pictures. We've been doing that since March 2013. Which was when we started reviewing all 123 AFI greats on their 1998 and 2007 lists of slickest American movies. We spoiled all those and will soon be spoiling Dr. Sleep. I'm the pup who will now take his medicine and whose life is scored to a never-ending heartbeat sound effect, just like this movie, Ryan Ellis. And here's the lady who knows that pain purifies steam, and then she eats all that steamy pain, my wife Bev.
Delicious.
Oh, good. And nobody shines like Bev.
Oh, thank you, dear.
Just like nobody shines like Abra. Dan Torrance, Danny Torrance in the original movie, of course, The Shining. Very powerful shiner. Abra puts him to shame with her talents and powers. Her last name? So Abra Stone. Boring last name for her. Should be Davis. Abra Davis. Abra Smith.
Abra is a dumb name.
Yes, it is.
It's so dumb.
Well, I'm not a huge fan of Rose the Hat in the first place. Look at all these names. Snakebite Andy, Apron Annie, Barry the, well, apparently in the book it was Chink, but here it's Barry the Chunk. Grandpa Flick is fine. Silent Sari, Diesel Doug, Short Eddie. They all have nicknames. They're all pretty lame. And I'm guessing they're all from the book, or, well, not Barry the Chunk, because they changed that. All right, anyway, the coming attractions opinion question for this week's picture, as we aren't quite in Scary Movie Month, but this is a scary movie sometimes. What is your favorite horror sequel of all time?
So I really didn't have an obvious answer for this.
Neither did I.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Aliens.
What a coincidence.
Do we both Google the same list and go, hey,
probably.
You know what? Yeah, Aliens is the only great movie on this list.
I meant to look at my collection, the Blu-rays over there at least, and just didn't do that. But I already had written down some as possibilities. Evil Dead 2 is a great movie.
Evil Dead 2 is a great one. There's a lot of good horror sequels, sure. But I don't think there's really a long list of great horror sequels.
Some of the sequels to the Friday Nightmare Halloween movies are as good as or better than the original. Of course, that's always an opinion. Some people would say, no, they're not. Well, some people think they are. Psycho 2, by the way, is a pretty good follow-up to the first film. I like it. I've seen it a few times. Okay, so we say Aliens, pretty good choice. I'm sure a lot of people will agree. Dr. Sleep was released by Warner Brothers, for some reason, a week after Halloween, on November 8th, 2019. Why not in early October?
God, really? Why not?
It wasn't much of a success, especially domestically. Nobody really went to see this picture. But it is 2 years old, Bev, so far in our rearview mirror, so please remind us what it's about with the Dr. Sleep skinny.
Ewan McGregor is Dan Torrance. You may remember him as the creepy psychic child who barely survived The Shining.
Red Rum.
Well, he's all grown up now, and he's all fucked up from childhood trauma.
Red Rum.
But he gets a chance to battle his demons by battling literal demons who hunt and kill people like him. People like him and people like Abra, a teenage girl with extraordinary shine that makes her both powerful and vulnerable. Abra and Dan work together to destroy the demons, or the True Knot, as they call themselves, by luring them to the condemned and abandoned Overlook Hotel, where hungry spirits are waiting to devour them.
Or, in a nutshell, never trust women who wear top hats and who aren't in a production of Cabaret.
I mean, I feel like top hats in general across the board, men, women, not to be trusted. Magic is a theme of the film, hence the name Abra. Good lord. Yeah. And there's a magician in the movie, and they're doing, quote, magic tricks that aren't actually magic.
A lot of things in this movie just don't work. Let's talk about what the critics thought, though, because they don't agree with us. You can tell we are not big fans. Well, they were mostly. 78% of critics on Rotten Tomatoes gave it favorable reviews. 7 out of 10 was the average on the strength of 331 reviews. So that's one hell of a good sample. And 89% of audiences. I'm assuming a lot of Shining fans. Probably. How do you watch this movie and not know? Well, I guess you probably could watch this and not know much about The Shining or even know The Shining, but it helps, of course.
I feel like people probably know the broad strokes of The Shining, whether they've seen it or not,
that could
because
be true.
It's just such a ubiquitous classic.
Like Psycho, for example. Dr. Sleep was 79th at the 2019 U.S. box office. Avengers Endgame was, of course, far and away number one. Us, we covered that last scary movie season, was number 12. Midsommar, we covered that, I believe, last summer, was 86th, and Booksmart, which we covered this year, was 93rd. We've done a lot of 2019 films the last year and a half or so, so when we get to 2024 and 2029, we'll have a lot fewer options as far as 5 or 10 years old movies. So that was a good year for movies, as was 2018, of course. Also, Dr. Sleep was nominated for a bunch of Saturn Awards and Fangoria Awards, but no Oscars or Golden Globes or SAGs, of course. What would it have been nominated for? Maybe, possibly, although you'd just say these are based on the original, the sets. Very impressive. Mike Flanagan, the director, the writer, the editor, and his team remaking these sets, which they also did, maybe more digitally, in Spielberg's Ready Player One. But here, these people are on these sets, acting through a big chunk of the end of the movie on what are recreated overlook sets. Very similar to the original movie, you hear the wind, even when you really shouldn't. They're in the middle of the hotel. But then, as people have pointed out about the Shining Hotel, it doesn't make logical sense, probably deliberately by Kubrick, or because, hey, he's a filmmaker who just didn't do continuity as well as he should have sometimes. But it makes sense in this weird story, this one or The Shining, that you hear wind in the middle of a hallway when you really shouldn't. Because both movies have that. Just like the heartbeat sound effect I mentioned a few minutes ago, definitely in The Shining, it is in a lot of this film. They play it maybe a little too much. But okay, big setup. We've already made it clear we're not big fans, but what are your thoughts initially here on Dr. Sleep, which is also a bit of a strange title for this story in this movie?
It was the title of King's book.
Well, of course, but then why does he call it that? Because right. The guy calls him that, literally calls Dan that. Okay, really?
Yeah, but why is he Dr. Sleep? He shouldn't really be the main character. Abra should be the main character. Anyway, The Shining is my all-time favorite movie, so in most ways, Dr. Sleep never stood a chance with me. Mike Flanagan is a very good director, but it is a mistake to welcome a direct comparison with one of history's greatest filmmakers by making a sequel to this film. There's a lot to like about Dr. Sleep, and I'm going to try and temper my criticisms with some praise, because there are some really cool things in it, and I think it's a really good-looking film with some very excellent performances, but I think I'm going to be pretty hard on it here.
I think we're in the minority about one big thing in this movie, and that is the ending.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
I heard back when this came out, generally, people thought it was either not good or, more than anything else, just playing too much on the original movie. That's where it finally got good for me.
I know.
The first time I saw this movie, I didn't really get or like the True Knot characters. The performances aren't terrible. Maybe it's Flanagan's fault, directing them, adapting King's book. It's probably more so King's fault, writing these characters in the first place with these bizarre nicknames and everything like that. Although, he's got some talented people in that group. Flanagan does. Zahn McLarnon plays Crow Daddy, who was great in season 2 of Fargo.
He's a great actor.
And he's also really good, as so many of them are, in that viscerally violent movie Bone Tomahawk from a few years ago, 5 or 6 years ago. If you haven't seen that, prepare yourself if you ever do. But he's in that, too. I think he plays a native, because I believe the guy himself is native, despite his last name being McLarnon. Must have Scottish blood as well. So the actors do what they're supposed to do, and they do it fine, I would say. But I didn't really care, and I guess maybe I'm dumb, but I didn't really get the first time I saw this movie, probably a few months after it came out, must have been when it was on demand and such. I don't think I fully grasped that these demons are specifically going after people who shine. I think I finally realized that more so when the baseball boy scene goes on.
I can't believe you missed that. It's pretty explicit.
Well, I told you, maybe I'm dumb.
Because I think it's because you sometimes are just on IMDb and
I may have been doing that
the
first time.
Things.
Yeah, because in a very small but excellent performance by Jacob Tremblay, who really sells fear better than most kids have ever done in any movie. And he's funny in Good Boys a couple years ago. I think it was the same year as this movie. And of course, his big break was in Room. But in that small performance, very powerful stuff. But they talk about at the game, two fathers, I think, are saying, oh, this kid always seems to know what pitch is coming. That's when I finally clicked in. Okay, he shines too. Obviously, Rose wants Dan, or especially Abra, to get that super duper PED level, if you will, of steam from these specific people that have this talent. They would have loved Dick if he was still alive.
I don't know if you knew this, but one of the dads who were talking at the baseball game is Danny Lloyd. Mm-hmm. All grown up. He's never acted since The Shining, but Danny Lloyd played Danny Torrance in the original The Shining.
That was going to be my trivia. I don't know how I was going to word it, but anyway, the point being that Danny Lloyd's only made The Shining, and now nearly 40 years later, the sequel.
I think it's even obvious about how the Trunot go after people with shine when they go after Violet, that little girl in their introduction scene. One of the many introductions in this movie, one of the many ways this movie starts, is it introduces the Trunot back in, I guess, the 80s.
Where 1980. I think it's supposed to be taking place the same time as what happens in The Shining.
Overlook. Okay. She traps Violet, and we learn who Rose the Hat is, and we get a gauge on that Trunot.
We need that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. She says Violet is special. That is why they have pursued her. But then they make it really obvious when they're talking about how there's not as many people who shine anymore. And when they tell us way too much.
They've been killing them. No wonder. They've been killing them.
No kidding. They just tell us way too much about the villains.
Well, the thing I know you agree with me on is, and even though he's very good in the film, and maybe not the most obvious casting, but Ewan McGregor, it's not his fault at all, but he has way too many scenes early on. You could have done it so much more economically in probably one scene to make it clear that this son of an alcoholic has now become an alcoholic. We get this whole buildup with him with a prostitute. He's doing drugs, but especially drinking. He has a train spotting moment where he sees a baby, although it's not a scary baby, some mechanical visual effect type thing. He steals that woman's money. You could have just had him, I think you even said it, stand up in AA and say, I'm Dan Torrance, I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah, getting his 8-year chip at AA, and he tells the story about his dad, and I'm like, this is where we should have met his character. Maybe not necessarily all in that scene. Ewan McGregor's such a great actor. He could give a monologue. You know, I thought about that beautiful scene in Hereditary where Annie, played by Toni Collette, is describing her relationship with her mother to her grief support group, and that beautiful performance adds so much depth to what's essentially an exposition scene, a scene that takes just minutes of screen time, but tells us what Dr. Sleep spent 30 minutes telling us. Ewan McGregor is a good enough actor to pull off a scene where he just describes what we spend way too much time seeing. And audiences are sophisticated enough to understand what rock bottom looks like. We don't need to spend the whole first act living it to understand where Dan is at. Maybe it's because Flanagan is coming from a television background, although he's made plenty of feature films. But Haunting of Hill House made whole episodes with elaborate backstories, which is fine because those were contained stories inside an episode. Television is a different kind of storytelling.
Excellent series, by the way.
Excellent. The first season, the second season, not as much.
Well, Haunting of Bly Manor, right, that's a whole different show.
Haunting of Hill House, wow, that is great television. Some of the most effective scares I've ever seen in anything took place in Haunting of Hill House, and Dr. Sleep is not scary. The Shining is a scary movie. Dr. Sleep has a couple of moments that might surprise you, but as far as that creep factor,
it's way more creepy than it is scary.
Yeah, one reviewer summed it up perfectly for me. The movie's entertaining enough that you're not going to fall asleep in the movie.
Fair.
But it will not keep you awake either. There's no images or anything that are really going to haunt you after the credits roll. You're just going to go back to your car, drive home, and talk about the weather on your way home. It just doesn't really stick with you.
But this guy's a track record with one great series of doing that exact thing. Bly Manor wasn't as effective, had some decent scares. One small sidebar on that, by the way, I think we agree on this one too. Maybe others won't. Victoria Pedretti is quite good as the older Nell in Hill House. But on Bly Manor, it's like they found this nice-looking, very friendly blonde person and said, can you act in our show? Sure I can! And then couldn't.
We could do a whole episode about everything that falls apart in Bly Manor. The terrible child actors. One of them plays Violet in Dr. Sleep. And yeah, you have good actors in Bly Manor doing pretty second-rate performances. Whereas we know this is a director who can get great performances out of his actors. So he's his own editor, you already mentioned that, and I'm an editor, so this is one of those movies that I just cannot stop myself from trying to fix. You know, sometimes you see a movie and you're like, oh, there's a good movie hiding in here. If I could have gotten the edit suite, I would take out all of that damn backstory. I would take out 90% of the Trunot backstory. No villain gets better the more you learn about them. This is an opposite relationship between how much you know about a villain and how cool they are as a villain. I have to evoke Patton Oswalt's famous comedy routine that he does about the Star Wars prequels. isn't Darth Vader the coolest villain of all time? Wouldn't you want to know what he's like as a 10-year-old?
Any.
Do you want to know what he's like when he's an annoying, whiny teenager? It ruins Darth Vader a little bit, and the Trunot could be cool villains. Rose the Hat, she had the potential to be an absolutely outstanding villain. She's got those laser eyes. You're making faces like you don't agree with me. But I think in a different movie, her performance...
I think a different actress.
Okay, I like her performance. We're going to disagree about this. They were so outrageous with how much they showed us and told us about the villains. Not only was it a waste of the movie's time, which has a long enough running time.
Two and a half hours. It's longer than The Shining.
But there is a whole scene where we see Rose the Hat, this centuries-old vampire.
Demon. Yeah, vampire, there you go.
In the grocery store, buying toilet paper. Do we need to know that she drinks Bud Light? We just learn way too much about them. So there's a whole story where they're recruiting Snakebite Andy.
Mm-hmm. Also, don't need to know any of that.
Completely unnecessary.
She's doing things with guys in the theater that remind you, say, of Hard Candy.
Yeah.
So getting these predators going after young girls and then her marking them and messing them up, fucking them over, fine, but who gives a shit? With this story, it has nothing to do with why Rose recruited her and turns her into a vampire. And seeing that she can do that, so what? That's not what she wants Dan and Abra for. She wants to take their incredible PED-level steam. She wants their Barry Bonds juice to be great at baseball, if you will. I'm really mixing and matching metaphors here. We didn't need any of that. You already said we needed less Trunot. That's true. My problem with Rebecca Ferguson, I don't think she's a bad actress. She hasn't done that much stuff that really stands out. She's one of the key members of the Mission Impossible team now, but no one thinks about anybody in those movies other than Cruise now. Maybe to some degree, Henry Cavill is the villain in, was that the last one? Fallout? Yeah. I think that was the last one, wasn't it? She's good to look at.
This is like the pettiest thing, but she's this centuries old demon, whatever she is, but she's supposed to have been a human once upon a time and have been alive for many, many, many centuries. And yet, she has these gigantic fake knockers.
Yes, exactly.
I guess I'm not supposed to notice, but they put her in outfits.
You can't not notice
hardly miss it. She's rather top-heavy. And I'm not saying it doesn't look good. I'm saying...
She's miscast.
This is miscasting. The same way that you couldn't cast her in a period piece. Maybe you can't cast her in a movie where she's supposed to have been born centuries ago.
Well, somebody who's awesome in this group, in a pretty small role, because him dying is one of the reasons why they're so motivated to make sure to get the best steam they can, or at least as much steam as they can, and why not go after Dan and Abra? Especially Abra. I don't think they really know about Dan for the longest time. He's been containing his power and talents and stuff, which is illogical. How do you do that? Anyway. Carol Struycken. Struycken, I don't know how you say his name exactly, Struycken. So he is the giant, is that what they call him in the Twin Peaks stuff?
I can't remember if they call him the giant, but he's the giant from Twin Peaks.
And he's also in Gerald's Game. Now there is one of the best things, other than Hill House, that Flanagan's done. I think it's his best movie, because I really like the Gerald's Game
book. Based on a Stephen King book as
also
well.
Also based on Stephen King. Hush is pretty good, where the girl is deaf, and I think it's his wife that plays that character. Gerald's Game also has his wife in a small role. But one of my favorites, Carla Gugino, has pretty much all the screen time. A little bit of Bruce Greenwood early on, and then it's mostly her and her, quote-unquote, not actual, but demons. He plays a person, I guess, who may or may not be real. Great casting for that, according to what King wrote in that book. There's a great piece of casting. And he's effective in this, too, especially, as you just said, looking like he's, I guess, centuries old, Grandpa Flick. Him dying is a key story point, too. But nobody else really looks like they should. The Barry character and, well, young Andy, I guess, has just been turned, Snakebite Andy, so okay, fine. Even Zahn McLarnon doesn't look like he's some kind of desperate for, well, it's not blood, but they are vampires. One of the great things about, say, Nosferatu, that he looks all messed up as he's starving for blood. He hasn't had it in so long. Well, they're rationing their steam. They're starving for their version of blood. So why do they look like this? And you could have made either Rose the Hat or some of the other characters just look more freaky and weird, almost zombie-like. Because she does do all the steam when she's the only one left. She just sucks it all down and you see her wounds heal. That's how effective this stuff is for her. So why don't they look way more messed up than they do? Other than when they get maybe the baseball boy steam and then finally, hey, we look good again for a few days or weeks.
Or they could have made her look pretty rough in the real world, but then when she's in Abra's mind, have her look much more young and beautiful.
Right.
And those scenes, by the way, in each other's minds.
I don't think they work.
Oh, I was just going to say. They were among my favorite
when
things.
When she flies across America.
So cool.
I don't get how that fits in with what we've been watching with The Shining before, because Flanagan's really doing a sequel to The Shining movie, not what King liked, his book.
It's a
and
compromise.
And the miniseries. Well, yes, but it's way more about, and Flanagan told King, if I'm going to do this, I want to do a sequel to the movie everyone loves, not your miniseries, which was pretty good, and not your book, which is also very good, but so different than the movie, and that's what he did.
So I don't know how intimately King was involved in the making of Dr. Sleep, but everyone knows that King hated Kubrick's adaptation of The Shining, and it seems unlikely to me he wouldn't have been hands-on here. Flanagan apparently had to really convince him that the overlook in the film at the ending, that it had to be there, that they had to honor the film version of the ending rather than the book version of the ending of The Shining. The overlook burns down in the book, but it's still standing at the end of the movie. And so they kind of had to find a way to blend the endings of both so that they could go back and see it again, give fans like me and you our fan service. And I wonder if Flanagan was compelled to keep a lot of those details that we're complaining about, like all the extra stuff about
the true King about that stuff.
Because all that stuff about addiction and hitting rock bottom, you know that's King's, one of his favorite things to write about, to explore, one of his favorite themes. He himself is a recovered alcoholic,
or
recovering alcoholic and drug addict. It is a theme over and over. We covered Misery. It's a huge theme in Misery, and it's a theme in The Shining, where you have an alcoholic, and in the book, this is what he hated the film version, is that in the book, it's really clear that it's a parable about addiction, whereas in the movie it's more
of a
parable about an abusive father, abusive or toxic family that turns on themselves.
Yeah, because in the book, Jack isn't trying to contain his rage at wanting to hurt Danny and Wendy all the time. And in The Shining book, when you have the flashbacks to his life as an alcoholic, or even as somebody who wasn't quite there yet but was getting to be that person, he wasn't a bad person from what they describe, what King describes, to Wendy. And when he breaks Danny's arm, thing you do a million times. You grab him by the arm and he put too much force, and he says the same thing to Lloyd. The way it's drawn in King's book is that's what did happen. But he lost control. He hurt his son because he was drinking. So you have to take responsibility. And that's one reason why he stops drinking in the movie. But in the book, it's more that, okay, he has a serious alcohol problem. No doubt about that. But he's not really abusive. He's not looking to kill his family. And there's a really key moment that they do in this and in the Shining miniseries as well, where now it's Dan, though, that's been taken over by the hotel and is going after the kid. That's a nice little reprise as well, where Dan's going after Abra, so he might as well be Jack going after Danny. But in all these cases, other than The Shining movie, there's a moment where the person who's possessed by the hotel with an axe in their hands, or a croquet mallet in the book, is going after the kid and is just about to get him. And in fact, Jack corners Danny in the book of The Shining, and he probably could kill him, but then he bursts through for a minute and says, Doc, and they always called Doc, right? His nickname as a
kid. Hence, Dr. Sleep.
Also plays into that, of course, too, yeah. Jack says something like, run away, Doc, run and hide, get away from me, I'm going to hurt you, I don't want to hurt you. So that's the real Jack coming through.
But which is the better ending? The ending where Jack is all the way turned evil and never has a redemption moment, or the corny, predictable, formulaic ending that Jack's heart just comes through in the end and saves his son? I like the ending of the movie. I've often said, because I love the film so much, and I've read so many Stephen King books, but I've never read The Shining because I love the movie so much. And I'm a huge reader, you know that. But I just never want to read the book. I've been tempted many times, but I'm like, no, I don't want anything to spoil my perfect impression of the film. You've told me a lot about the film and about moments like this. That's awful. That ruins it. What's great about the movie is that it doesn't pull its punches, because you know what? Sometimes fathers are evil. Sometimes mothers are evil. Sometimes people kill their family. That level of abuse, it exists. This is a story about that next level of violence, of abuse, and of a vile human being. Now, of course, he's possessed, but if you're going to use the metaphor of drinking, when you get drunk, you message people and tell them how much you love them. You talk to the dogs in a baby voice.
What?
And like...
I do that anyway.
You get the, as I like to call it, the I love you mans. Mm-hmm. Because that's what happens to you when you're drunk. I'm never like, uh-oh, Ryan's drunk. I hope he doesn't pull on my arm so hard accidentally that he dislocates my shoulder. Alcohol doesn't make you do bad things. It just lowers your inhibition enough that you do the bad things that you probably wanted to do sober.
Okay, exactly. Yeah, all right, fine. And that's what Kubrick put on the screen, but King wanted the guy that comes through at that last minute. Dan does here in the miniseries and, of course, in the original book.
And they kind of want to use alcohol as an excuse for bad behavior. And probably a lot of alcoholics love that story. It wasn't me that did it. It was the drugs and alcohol.
And it wasn't even the booze. It was a hotel.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's all a metaphor.
Well, I was just reading the ending in the Wikipedia form. It's not the actual book, but just the synopsis of the ending of the book. And this plays into the same thing, that Kubrick likes the optimism. Because it did burn down in the book, but not in the original Shining movie. So they couldn't go back to the actual hotel. But they go to the grounds of the hotel, Dan and Abra. And that's where the True Knot, at least one of the places, they're staying. So it really does come full circle that they're there. Dan does say to Abra in this movie, it's dangerous for people like us, but it will also be dangerous for someone like her. But in the book of Dr. Sleep, they're already there. The other thing that I actually like better in this than reading that small description there is that Jack is somehow involved as a ghost, I guess, and I think he helps them win. But at the very end, it says on Wikipedia that he waves to Dan and they finally have their closure, his closure with his father. But in this movie, I don't mean this as a criticism. I actually like that, and it's a pretty solid performance, a pretty good Jack impression. Who hasn't done a Jack impression in their life, really, for an actor? But Henry Thomas, who's been in so many of the things that Flanagan's done, especially those two big series, he's playing young Jack, and here's what was well done, but it's also disappointing, just as a human being. He sees his dad again. Okay, it's the hotel being his dad, but still, he's talking to what could be his dad again. But his dad isn't nice. His dad's not giving him advice. He's not waving goodbye. He's a fucking asshole to him.
He's one of the ghosts, just like...
He's not really his dad in that sense, I know, but yeah.
No, I know, but he truly has been absorbed into the hotel, and he is pure evil, as he should be. I don't want to see the good Jack come through. I feel like it ruins it. I don't know if Henry Thomas is the world's best casting to play Jack Nicholson.
Pretty good,
I feel
solid.
Like they could have done a little better, but he's a good enough actor to pull it off, which is nice. Okay, he doesn't really look the part, and he's not really convincing me. And the actress who plays Wendy does a slightly better job of doing like a real Shelley Duvall impression.
I think Alex Esso,
her voice.
Yeah, the look and the style, the whole performance of Alex Esso is pretty good. She's quite good in a movie called Starry Eyes. Pretty good horror film from a few years ago, by the way.
But I do love that they chose to just cast actors to do it, rather than try to digitally recreate it and give us all that Uncanny Valley version that's going to look like hot garbage in 10 years.
Or have Jack come back, a guy who they say can't remember his lines anymore. He hasn't acted in what's now 11 years.
They tried to get him. They said he was just too committed to being retired, which some people have guessed is that he's suffering some kind of dementia or Alzheimer's, but they're just keeping away on the DL, which is fine. It's none of our business.
Shelley Duvall also, I don't know if they asked her to be in it, but she was alive when they made this movie, wasn't she?
Yeah, she just had a big profile last year.
Is she still alive now then?
Oh yeah, she's still alive, but she hasn't acted in a very long time either. But I just think that they made the right decision to just go with actors who were very talented and I think probably brought more to the film by just recreating these characters and
Alex
giving
Esso,
their own performances.
Alex Esso has more to do, too, because they do show some scenes, again, we don't need them, where the young Danny, just after the events of The Shining, they end up in Florida. So she has scenes there, and then she's also in the hotel as obviously just a figment of his imagination as a ghost. The scenes in Florida, I took a note for this. Why did they end up there? Did they go to where Dick was staying? Because in the book, The Shining, and of course the movie, The Shining, Dick has gone to Florida for the winter. So I was thinking at that point, why do they go to Florida? But then Dan does say later on to Abra or somebody that they went there because they never wanted to see snow again.
Right.
Okay, so that makes some sense. Yeah.
There could have been like a little attraction to Florida because that's where Dick was. Florida might feel like a safe place. That's where
But he's dead in the movie, but in the book of The Shining, he got them out of there. So he lived with them for a little bit. There's an epilogue in the book as well, The Shining book. So he's with them for a little bit, but in the movie they have to acknowledge that no, he's just a ghost. He can guide Danny still and help raise him in a way, but as a ghost. And we see him more than once. Carl Lumley does play Dick in those flashback scenes effectively, because most of this movie is set in 2019, even though we see scenes of 1980 and then 2011.
I loved his performance. I think he did a great Dick Halloran. It was convincing to me. And initially, when I first saw his performance, I was like, how did they do that? But when you look, he doesn't really look like him. I think he just captures his spirit perfectly. So there is a director's cut to this film.
What? Even longer?
30 minutes
oh
to the runtime
God,
of a three-hour movie. Just make a miniseries at this point, which is probably what they should have done. Either that or take my edit suggestion. Or let me make the movie.
Because ironically, you want to make a movie rather than a miniseries because you want to make more money because it gets released theatrically, but this failed.
Yeah, apparently they really overestimated how much young people care about The Shining. I guess that it's a movie that hasn't carried through generation to generation and young people haven't seen it or just don't care about it.
Or they want to watch that on DVD or Blu-ray over and over again, not watch a sequel.
We never did see it in the theater.
Sure, you think that
we'd be... I
really
wanted to, and I can't remember why it didn't work out, but we were busy at the time or something, and it was in theaters for like a minute, and then it was gone. So anyways, in the director's cut, there's a lot more scenes with Dick and much more time spent where he talks about the time Dan had with his mother when she was dying. And he has this whole story about how, because when he knows that people are dying, we haven't really talked about how his job is to work in a hospice clinic and he always can tell when people are about to die.
As can that cat.
As can the cat. I guess the cat shines, right? He can always tell when people are dying and he aids them in dying. Really sweet, little empathetic use of his powers. But he tells Dick that he can tell they're dying because they start getting covered in flies. And then when his mother was dying, all he could see were flies. Now, they weren't really there, but that's how he could tell that she was dying. And he couldn't tolerate it. He couldn't even look at her. And he felt really guilty about the fact that she was dying and her son couldn't look in her eyes. So that is a better explanation for why at the end of the film, when he's dying to protect Abra and to kill the demons, and he's in the boiler room and he's about to burn to death, he sees his mother and she looks in his eyes. And that's why that's supposed to be a cathartic moment, a moment that's completely lost on us in the theatrical cut. Because honestly, when that happens, I'm like, really, his mother? That's a relationship that needed to be resolved?
Seemed like it was fine.
Okay.
She died when he was young, and that's terrible, but otherwise they had a good relationship.
I kind of thought it was more about the safety of childhood, right? That was the one person who truly loved him in this world that was so aggressive to him, and everything was trying to kill him, but his mother really loved him. But I had to really intellectually get there. It wasn't something that was intuitive.
Okay.
It's like they cut the wrong things in the film. And as much as I would want to cut so much out of it, I would want some of those other moments to really breathe. The Shining is a really slow movie that forces you to sit in moments, even if they're really uncomfortable and they're really slow paced, and just forces you to live in those moments and to feel the emotional resonance of a man trying to murder his wife.
It's more about
his child, or the creepiness, the way he talks to her, the way he talks to Danny. These scenes are so creepy. Think about how long it takes that woman to get out of the tub and reach him. That's the way Kubrick makes the film, whereas the way Flanagan makes the film is it's a third of the length and we're just snapping through it, and there isn't that same build up, so you don't get the fright and there isn't the emotional breathing room. Did you feel emotionally connected to any of the relationships?
No, that's been the problem with the two times I've watched it. And the word I was going to say there is dread in the original movie. Also, it's almost it's more than 40 years ago now, but when they made Dr. Sleep, it was almost 40 years before. And movies were generally slower back then. Even the action movies were a lot slower than they are now, generally. Even a slow action movie now is a better pace, and faster pace at least, than movies made in the 70s, 80s, that kind of thing, generally. I did think that the woman in the bathtub stuff was pretty effective. Okay, maybe too fast, maybe not drawn out enough, but that's also playing off the idea of a dream. The way that Jack talks with Grady in that famous scene in the bathroom, when Grady tells him he's got to correct his son and correct his wife.
Corrected.
Thank you, I can't roll my R's. That plays like a dream, the way they talk to each other, just like Eyes Wide Shut a lot of the time does, with Cruise repeating people's dialogue over and over again. That movie's slow, deliberately. That plays definitely like a dream. And The Shining's not that, but it has moments of dreamlike type stuff. But I thought that the bathtub woman, who's used as one of his worst memories, as she should be, the only thing that actually does hurt him in the movie, she chokes him at least briefly. We don't see it, but we know that she did that. Jack never touches him. That's one of the great things about The Shining as a movie.
True.
One person dies on screen in this famous horror film. We see the girls have been cut up from long ago. We see, great party, isn't it? That guy's head is split open. But we don't see any of that stuff happen. Jack never touches Wendy in the scene where
Jack's death is off camera.
Yeah, and he just freezes to death.
Mm-hmm.
So all that stuff's terrible, but for a horror film, it's actually pretty tame. But that's probably deliberate on Kubrick and even King in his books. Point.
When people talk about The Shining, they talk about it as if it was like a traumatizing experience the first time they saw it. I think I was like 12 or something the first time I saw it. One of the scariest movies I'd ever seen.
And it's about family violence without actually showing family violence. We talked about it in that podcast, we did it many years ago, that after they first get to the hotel, the closing day scene with Ullman and Watson and, of course, Dick and everybody, we never see the three family members on screen together again. Obviously, they had plenty of scenes where they are together, and that's one of the better parts of the book. This is a truly loving family. Jack has a real serious problem. And then, of course, one of the best things in that book is when he's, as he does, I guess, in the movie, but he imagines he's drunk. He imagines he's blasted drunk, singing at the top of his lungs in the Colorado Lounge, and Danny and Wendy can hear this thinking, what is he doing? I don't know if they really play that off in the movie the same way. So Danny's worst memory of any of that will be his father chasing him, obviously, and trying to kill him. But he was only ever physically touched by one ghost, so of course she'd be the one that would freak him out the most, and he puts her in that box. This is why I think I like the ending at the hotel more than a lot of other people do. I guess they think it's fan service, and generally I'd be annoyed by that too. They could have been Abra's villains, and they already are Dan's villains. So Dan goes back, he finally deals with this at the hotel, he uses them to kill her. That's pretty clever, actually, that he uses the ghosts to kill her, but then they come after him and take him over. Okay, fine. But it pays off his story, and Abra just being part of it because she's so powerful. This hotel wants her now. We wanted Danny when he was a little kid. We really want Abra now rather than the True Knot. I don't really get why they're in there.
But Abra, she's cool in the sense that her power makes her vulnerable, but she is stronger than everybody else in the film, and she has this great self-possession. She's a person who was born with the same talent that Danny had.
Also telekinesis, but though. Because she makes those forks and knives and spoons, whatever it is. They're levitating in the kitchen. Danny can't do that as a kid or as an adult.
But she has good parents who love her. Mm-hmm. So she's a much more well-adjusted person. And she can use her power and, like, control it. An interesting little detail I thought that was cool. Her and Dan are talking about how they interpreted the voices in their heads, how they interpreted each other. And she says, I thought you were my imaginary friend. And he says, oh, I had an imaginary friend, too. I thought The Shining was Tony, my imaginary friend. Was Tony a person that was communicating with Danny, with The Shining?
This is one thing you know if you read The Shining book. His name is Daniel Anthony Torrance.
Oh, right, it's his middle name.
So it suggests that the older version of himself is leading himself through in the book.
Oh, like it's a time travel thing.
Well, in a way, I guess. In the movie, though, he just says at one point, he's a little boy that lives in my mouth, and then he does that voice and uses the finger.
It's so creepy!
But it doesn't matter where he gets Tony from in that sense. It's just what that kid called his imaginary friend. But in The Shining book, that becomes extraordinarily clear. That's where he got that name from.
Speaking of loving The Shining, I'm not a capital F fan of Star Wars or comic books or most of the most popular franchises that are always coming back around with each generation. So when things are added to films as, quote, fan service, I'm usually one of those people who doesn't care or doesn't get it, or worst case scenario, I find it annoying. This is one of the very few times I can say that I am the fan being serviced here. I didn't know what it felt like before. And let me tell you, it worked. We've been talking about how we liked the ending and other people didn't like it. I loved it. I loved all the stuff of the Overlook. I was aghast to see critic after critic complain that it was the worst part of the film because that's what I wanted more of. I just wanted to be back in the Overlook so bad.
If you're going to do a sequel to The Shining, and the hotel's still standing, dilapidated and abandoned, which would probably never happen, by the way, because somebody would say, there's market value in this thing. I don't care if it's got all these stories about it.
Yeah, somebody would just tear it down and build a new hotel.
Well, of course, in The Shining movie, they talk about how it was, I think this may be in the book too, that it was built on an ancient Indian burial ground. So that's one reason why all the spirits may be affecting the dead people and having them come back. I don't know, but that's one of the subtexts there, I guess. But yes, the fact that they go back to the hotel and he has to confront all these bad memories and demons and stuff, and he's put them in these lockbox type things in his mind and then unleashes them. And maybe Dick told him that too. If you ever need the, well, I guess Dick wouldn't have known that. But anyway, he knows enough to use them against Rose to finish her off. But at the very end, it's Abra who sees this woman in the bathtub that was Dan's experience. In reality, this ghost choked him, or maybe more arguably choked himself. But anyway,
she's not afraid at all. She doesn't piss her pants the way Danny does when he's a little boy and he sees this ghoul comes.
But we
back.
See him deal with it as well. I think as the adult version, he goes into the bathroom, closes the doors, if I'm going to finally deal with this, mm-hmm. and put her in the box that she belongs in, along with everyone else.
So tough. What did you think of Kylie Curran and her performance?
She's only been in one other movie. She's fine. She's not bad.
She's fine.
The best of the three in this movie, the big three, McGregor, Ferguson, and Curran, is, I know I'm a white man, but the white man, McGregor's the best thing.
I love McGregor. He's one of my longtime favorites.
He's so good in so many movies. We haven't covered him very often. This is one of the few times we've ever covered McGregor. Of course, we did do Trainspotting many years ago. I think it was 5 years ago. But I'm not sure we've done anything else with him in it. If we have, I can't think of anything else. I already made clear I'm not a huge Ferguson fan. Maybe it's Flanagan's fault. Maybe it's King's book's fault. But I don't think she's a great villain in this. I don't think it's written that well. I don't think she plays it that well. But as for the kid,
it suffers from too much information.
That may be true, too. But as for the kid, she's okay. She's the main character, but we all want it to be Dan, has to play up his story. So, you know, one thing that's actually interesting about her, though, in the Dr. Sleep book, he's not Uncle Dan. And of course, that's just a moniker she gives him anyway, but he's not Uncle Dan. He would be Brother Dan, because apparently Jack had an affair with her mother.
Oh.
But in the casting of this, Kylie Curran is black, Zachary Momo, her father, David, is black, but the mother is white. The most useless mother in a long time in movies we've covered. Maybe not most useless ever, but pretty useless in this movie. But she's white. So you could have done the same thing in this, and it would have been more story we didn't need.
Well, it's possible that if they found their actress, they found Kylie Curran, and she's the best actress for the role, and she just happens to be black, so just cast parents that will look convincingly like her parents. It's way harder to cast a girl her age than to cast adults.
Oh, my point, though, is that Jack couldn't have had an affair with the Jocelyn Donahue character, with Lucy Stone.
Yeah, but they could have just cast a black woman to play her mother if they wanted to.
Well, I know, but the way they cast it, that couldn't have fit in this particular casting.
But also the age difference. Jack was long dead before Abra was conceived.
Right. So maybe I misread what that was all about. But okay, fine. Here's the point. Dan and Abra were related in the book, and they don't need to be. The fact they both have this great power and she finds him through the writing on the wall, that was a good touch. We like that, definitely, right? That she writes on the wall.
I thought that was a great detail. You see that they're writing to each other, and you see it's not a scary thing, that it's like a happy relationship, this little pen pal thing they have going on the chalkboard. There's a scene after Jacob Tremblay, the baseball boy, is murdered by the True Knot. She tells Dan what happened because she sees it in her clairvoyance.
That's one reason her power's even stronger than Dan's, because she can see stuff happening now and
feel it. Well,
he
can see through her, too. He can connect through her. So he.
But his power was always about things happening long ago.
He's always trying to suppress his power.
Right.
Whereas she's embracing it much more. So she communicates this to Danny by simply writing murder, backwards, red rum. He says who, and she says baseball boy. This is true economic storytelling, and this is what I wish the film had so much more of. We learn in that moment that they have a lexicon with each other, that they know about other people who shine, and that they care about the welfare of other people who shine. We learn so much about their relationship in that moment with just two words, baseball boy. And the audience could figure it out.
Well, Dan obviously realizes he has a responsibility to her because very few people can do what he and she can do.
But he's reluctant to help her. It's a little bit of a contrived conflict in the book that when she comes and finds him in Tiny Town.
Right. Yeah, he tells her, just turn it off. Tell her more then. Give her more guidance. Dick does come back. I think the scene after that is as if to say, you can't just leave it like that. You got to do more than you've done. You owe her this. Yeah. Be responsible.
He gives his life to protect her, basically, and just set
which
her
does
up
not happen.
Success.
Also, I talked earlier about King's version of happy endings. He lives through Dr. Sleep. He survives, just like Dick does in the Shining book, but does not survive the movie.
So I've been a fan of King, like I said, since I was a kid. I started reading him probably when I was too young to start reading him. And I've read plenty of his more recent work. And I'm not going to call it bad, because I keep going back for more, and I've never not finished one of his books, despite their epic page counts.
Yeah.
But I would say it's been well over a decade since King wrote something that I wouldn't call third-tier Stephen King. By the accounts I've read, I have never read Dr. Sleep, but a lot of people who have said, this is not his best, not even close. And what is he guilty of in his more recent work? Exactly all the things we're complaining about with the movie. Way too many details, way too much backstory, self-indulgent writing. You just need an editor, sir. Even though he publishes like two books a year still, it's rather incredible. He's such a prolific writer, but it's just like nobody, I guess, has the nerve to cut him down anymore, and he's too in love with every detail of his story.
But they know his stuff will sell. Dr. Sleep, the book, sold very well.
Yeah, exactly.
It won awards, I believe.
I think it's fair to lay the blame for some of the dumber elements of this film at King's feet. Some stuff that he writes in books, you can buy into it in a book, but it looks just like Dreamcatcher. I'm not saying Dreamcatcher is not
movie.
A good book. Something that does not work in a film. The casting was bizarre. You can suspend your disbelief more in a novel, I think. Your imagination just has way more power in a book than it does in a film. And so you have a lot more forgiveness for things.
Dreamcatcher is the only time that Morgan Freeman's been truly bad in a movie, and he was truly bad in that film.
When I saw he got cast as Kurtz, it just blew my mind.
Well, also, I've said this many times, we've covered a few different Stephen King adaptations. Shawshank Redemption is one. Of course, we know about The Shining, Carrie.
The Stand.
Well, no, we haven't done that. The Dead
not
Zone.
Not The Stand, sorry. The Body.
Stand By Me.
Stand By Me, that's
right.
What
so we've done a lot of King, basically, over the years. He's such a visual writer. You can see things he's written so well.
Yeah, he writes cinematically.
And apart from the ones that we've covered, because we basically have covered, except for this, the really good Stephen King stuff. So credit to him with his original story, but also credit to the filmmakers, the actors, the directors, and everybody who made those movies into the good movies that they are. But he's so visual with his writing, and yet so many of the times his movies haven't succeeded. I don't know why, because he's already written visually for you what to put on the screen, and yet these people over and over again failed in most of his stuff.
What do you make of the Stephen King remakes at this point? Because it was a gigantic hit.
That's why this got made.
Dr. Sleep was kind of on the back burner, and it looked like the studios were going to kill it, and that would be the end of it. And then it made an absolute fortune.
And then Flanagan also having a successful time on television, and with Hush and Gerald's Game as movies that did pretty well. Maybe one or even two of those only got released on Netflix, I don't recall, but they probably got good download numbers at least. They both are on Netflix now, or at least have been on Netflix. That's how I saw both of them. Those are all reasons why this got made. And King's name, of course, as well. The book came out in 2013, so 6 years passed. That's quite a long time for a King turnaround.
I think Pet Sematary was also a hit. The new Pet Sematary?
No, but it wasn't a bomb either.
Not like Dr. Sleep was.
And as far as Dan not making out of this story, but he did make out of the book story of Dr. Sleep. I was arguing with somebody today, a few people, in fact, on Twitter. Some Americans, I'm assuming, going on and on about freedom, freedom, freedom. Well, let me quote Spider-Man. With great freedom comes great responsibility. Or paraphrase, at least.
That's not the quote.
Well, I'm paraphrasing then. You want to be free all the time, you've got to be responsible. And I think that's one of the things that Dick, without maybe literally saying it, is telling Dan, is that you have this kind of talent and this kind of power. You need to help this girl. You owe her that because you can. And also, if anybody had to die of the major characters, too bad her dad died. That's a shame. And of course, all the True Knot ends up dead, but they're all villains, so that's fine. They're not even human beings anyway. But of the two of them, you're not going to kill the kid anyway. But Dan didn't have anything else anyway. His best friend's dead now. His parents are long dead. He's finally dealt with this trauma. He's going to be able to live on as a memory or as a ghost. I'm sure the first time I saw this, I knew that he wasn't actually alive at the end when he's standing in her room. For one thing, he doesn't have any scars in his face because he does have some in what happens at the end of the story when they're in the Overlook. But he had no life anyway, and I wonder if he maybe never had a real relationship or got married because he saw how bad things can be. And I think one thing they maybe didn't pay off, and maybe they didn't need to, or they think they did. Flanagan maybe thought he did by having him come after Abra when he's possessed. The cycle of violence thing. There's a cycle of alcoholism, yes, but there isn't really a cycle of violence. Dan's not a violent person until he's possessed, and then coming after his kid figure, not real kid.
But he is a violent person. When we see the flashbacks, he gets in that terrible bar fight with that dude, and he picks up a pool ball and smashes him in the face with it, and somebody's like, is he dead? The notion is he might have even killed that guy in a fight, so he is a violent person.
But I meant more in the sense of he's not killing the girls he sleeps with, though, or hurting that baby. But that may also...
He just kills them with negligence. They are dead.
Right, but also they're not his actual responsibility, and that's maybe why he never got close to anybody.
Oh, yeah, I totally buy that. That's his reaction to his family trauma, that he never gets married, he never has a girlfriend. And all the years that he's in that town with Cliff Curtis, getting sober...
New Jersey, yeah.
Yeah.
This movie is set in a lot of America. New Jersey, a little bit of Florida, obviously, at the end in Colorado. We see the Midwest. They drive 18 hours to Iowa, he and Billy do. So that's Cliff Curtis's character. So it does go all across America, but it mostly seems to have just been shot in Georgia and then in Oregon, very briefly, of course. They actually reuse some of the shots that Kubrick had for The Shining and then just make it look like it's nighttime. You could tell, if you know The Shining movie well enough, what shots they reused for his car going up to the Overlook, contrasting to when Jack goes up there for his interview.
And they reuse shots that they are welcoming us to recognize as straight from the movie, like the blood coming from the elevator. You can tell that's the exact same shot.
That or Rose sees,
Rose
yeah.
just walks by, looks at it, and it's like, cool! And then just keeps going. In The Shining, that is such an iconic moment of terror.
And who sees that in, well, quote-unquote reality, because of course Danny imagines it, he shines it, but who sees it when it, quote-unquote, actually happens
well,
in The
Wendy,
Shining?
Right?
Wendy sees
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's one thing that somebody else pointed out a few years ago, and I've seen The Shining so many times and know the book well and everything, obviously. But I never really thought about the fact that obviously we know Jack shines too because he imagines Lloyd, he imagines the party in the ballroom, and he imagines Grady more than once. But then Wendy is seeing things that aren't there too at the very end. She isn't until the last moments that they're all in the hotel together.
It would help explain why Danny's shine is so powerful if both of his parents shine.
Mm. And they just don't know it because, as Dick says, most people don't know they have the ability. Mm-hmm. And obviously Wendy and Jack Torrance didn't know that. So we're going to talk about vampires next week, and we have vampires this time, but in a different way because they inhale steam.
Yes.
Fine,
steam
a theme that works
thermoses.
Okay, I guess, a little weird. You want to say something about this, the thermoses?
I just hate the thermoses. I know a lot of people have ripped on the thermoses, but it is so dumb that they have like a scientific way almost, because it looks like it comes from a lab. It looks like something you would keep DNA samples in. If it's going to be something mystic, let it look like something mystic. Let it look like a magical object, like her hat. Not saying keep the steam in the hat. That would also be kind of dumb.
That'd be really dumb.
But I'm saying it would make more thematic sense. Like the boxes in Danny's head, they have that
they're
magical...
metaphorical.
Yeah, they're metaphorical, and they kind of look like magic as we understand magic to look. the whole film has this magic theme to it. So why would you choose these laboratory-looking thermoses? If they've been alive for centuries, when were the thermoses invented? Because they look like they came from a lab this year, but they contain samples of people that they were supposed to have killed perhaps years and years ago.
Well, they repickled them and put them in different jars.
It is so dumb.
But again, we don't need to see any of this anyway, because they're the villains. You don't need to know what Michael Myers does in his downtime. There's a funny gag that Roger Ebert talks about when he turns up the lights in houses on some of the Halloween movies. Did he learn electrical boxes in his downtime? And, okay, well, they need to work on this wiring. This could start a fire.
When does he eat and go to the bathroom?
Right.
But it's better that you don't see it.
He eats a dog in the first movie.
Okay.
They say that. We don't see it.
Fine. When does he poop, then?
Well, nobody poops in TV or movies unless it's necessary for the plot. I did like the way this paid off, though, too, getting back to the ending for a minute, that it does pay off the book of The Shining, where Jack has to dump the boiler because it's this old cheap thing. And Jack's job, why he's there in the first place, is to do basic maintenance. But that would be fixable in the spring, really, if you think about it. It's because they have to make sure that it doesn't completely freeze over, and they can't trust the boiler to be left on its own. Well, that isn't a plot point really at all in the movie of The Shining. We see Wendy down in the boiler room once, that's it. But in the book, it's such a key plot point. And then Jack, when he's possessed, forgets to do it. That's why it explodes in the book. Well, in this movie, and you couldn't do it in the Dr. Sleep book because King already blew up the hotel. But you could do it in the movie, and it finally pays off that Dan knows about this, and he makes sure that it does explode and finally gets rid of that fucking hotel. And, of course, sees his mother at the very end and has a last moment with her, which is pretty nice. Although, as you say, it would have made more sense if we understood why it means something for him to look at his mother.
It just didn't feel like the relationship that needed to be resolved.
Mm. Well, the cast is very multicultural. We've got a Scottish and Swedish lead with McGregor and Ferguson, and then a young black girl who hadn't really acted before.
Cliff Curtis is Maori.
He's all right. Another one. He's, I guess, the fourth lead. Yeah, he's fourth billed here on the IMDb. We've already covered him in The Piano and Three Kings, where he plays an Iraqi and, I guess, a Maori. He'll be in the Avatar sequels, by the way, so he's going to make some serious bank for years. He's apparently in all of those.
If those movies ever get made.
No, they're being made now. They probably would have come out, one of them, by now, except for the pandemic. Bruce Greenwood's briefly in this movie. His office is very similar to the way Ullman's office was set up, obviously intentional by Mike Flanagan, although there's no connection between the two, but Ullman's the manager in The Shining. We've covered him before in The Sweet Hereafter, and he's one of the best JFKs of all time. A lot of people play JFK, but him in 13 Days, one of the best ones I've seen. And we talked about Thomas, Esso, Lloyd, and Lumley as, well, there you go, there's the family. Henry Thomas, Alex Esso, Danny Lloyd, who's not actually in the family, but he's in the movie, and he's from the original movie, and Carl Lumley playing Dick, all of them in smaller supporting roles. Producers John Berg and Akiva Goldsman was an executive, incidentally, so the guy who wrote Beautiful Mind won an Oscar for that. Berg produced Elf, polar opposite movie, and now he's working on DCEU films, so he's got some very serious stuff going on there, the DCEU. We've already talked about Flanagan's credits as a writer, director, and an editor. His cameraman, Michael Fimagnari, I hope I'm saying that right, he works with Flanagan all the time. He shot other horror flicks too, but a lot of Flanagan's, if not all of Flanagan's films. And then the composers, this is obviously a Flanagan choice, and they work with him quite a bit, so they know him well. But the Newton Brothers with that...
I liked the score.
Yeah, but that sound effect of the heartbeat, overused too much.
All right.
They did work on his miniseries, by the way. It's 185:1. We saw it on Crave, so on demand. One of the reasons why I thought I'd choose it is because I felt like talking about it. I think we've had a pretty good discussion here, but also because it was free and available. And we are in the minority on this movie because we didn't love it that much, and we didn't like the same things other people liked. As for what happens next, well... authorities hold Dan's estate responsible for burning down the hotel, because it's his fault it happened. Fortunately, he doesn't own anything, so, as Rocky says in Rocky V, sue me for what?
I know, he doesn't even have a next of kin. Right. What are you going to go after, his birthday?
I guess you have to go after Abra.
Yeah.
His niece, quote-unquote.
Well, for the what happens next, you really could call this Abra's origin story.
Now she can be a superhero.
Very much be a superhero.
So maybe John Berg will produce a movie of hers in the future in the DCEU. Okay, well, we're not quite in Scary Movie Month, but this is a supposed horror film. Definitely has some creepy moments. The bones of something really good are here. It didn't pay off. Way too much True Knot stuff. I did like them a little bit more this time around, maybe because I got out of the stupid camp and realized what exactly they're doing in this, but still didn't think they were necessary. I appreciated the hard work that especially McGregor and Curran did. I did like some of the recastings with Thomas and Esso and everything, but your last thoughts?
I would consider this film a failure, unfortunately, but it is a very well-shot, well-acted, and entertaining failure. I wouldn't discourage anyone from seeing it, but I would insist that they put up with me listing its flaws afterwards, like the true toxic fan that I am.
There you go. Well, we're not fans, but it did provide for a good discussion. That's good, because he wants to talk about a boring movie. If we just sat here and said, so, that happened. We're passionate because it could have been awesome, and it just wasn't.
I know.
Okay, in 7 days, we'll continue talking about vampires, only this time the subject will be the most famous bloodsucker of all time, Dracula. The 1931 version, which we've already watched. Spanish language version made at the same time, by the way, on the same sets, and came out the same year.
Oh, wow.
And it's on the DVD we have. You have to choose which one you want to watch. Ha!
Different actors.
Yeah.
Ha!
I think the story's the same, but different cast, and of course, they spoke Spanish. The coming attraction's opinion for Dracula. It's been adapted and bastardized dozens, maybe even hundreds of times. Here's a little fun thing. Let's recast Drac yet again. They've done it so many times. Let's do it at least once more in our own minds. Who would be the ideal choice if they launched yet another lavish production of Bram Stoker's Main Man? And I already have someone in mind myself.
So for the answer to that question, check out next week's podcast about Dracula. And for more from us, you can visit our website, top100project.com. And don't forget to favorite or subscribe wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made. And we've done hundreds more titles on top of that.
And if you want to find our review of The Shining, it is way back in,
pretty deep.
2014. The week before or after that we did 2001 A Space Odyssey, we did that as what we called then a not 100 project movie when we were doing the top 100 project movie. So look way back.
Yeah. In exchange for all of this great content while you're there, please leave us a rating and a review because that helps people find us. We're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT for a 20% discount. And that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive.
I have a solution to all this. Let's just go watch The Shining.
Definitely am dying to now that we have seen this and talked about it so much.
Maybe 9 p.m. and you're about to go to bed in an hour and a half.
But okay, we'll have to watch it tomorrow.
Soon.
And cut.
Daddy! Daddy boy! Abra! Abra girl!